Support for 30 Days of West Virginia Music is provided by Made in WV, a specialty apparel company made by and for proud West Virginians, online at madeinwv.com. Support is also provided by Kinship Goods, proud supporter of DIY music and the arts, locally shipped worldwide at kinshipgoods.com.
I'm not talking about the dirty projectors, Bon Iver sort of synthesizery thing that they picked up, you know, off the 909 machine. I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about the things that sound as if they've just been done right in somebody's garage in somebody's bedroom. You know, I think it's Johnston, right? Those recordings still feel incredibly contemporary. And they were probably incredibly laughable, right, when they were done. And that's the purpose of, you know, artists like Johnston is, you know, to kick those things open so that, you know, you can have the possibilities.
I'm Joni Deutsch, and this is 30 Days of West Virginia Music, a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and A Change of Tune. Throughout the month of June, we are celebrating some of the folks who are making the West Virginia music scene wild and wonderful. 30 days, 30 brand new West Virginia music interviews. And today, a critically acclaimed author from Beckley, West Virginia, and his unique take on a cult favorite musician from the Mountain State. This is Scott McClanahan. Can you introduce yourself and what you do?
Oh God, the what you do might be hard. But I'm Scott McClanahan, and I don't like the what I do question. I'm unsure about that.
So what don't you do? Does that make it easier?
What don't I do? Maybe that's even worse. I'm already being a difficult interview subject.
Could you say that you are a writer, an author?
I wouldn't say author. I think the word writer is okay, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. So Scott McClanahan.
I'm Scott McClanahan, and I'm a writer.
Cool. And now, Scott, this is an interesting interview because...
But with a lowercase w.
Why? What's the difference?
I don't know. You know, like those writer people. They're always so annoying. It's like, you know, capital L literature, capital W writer.
Capital T theater with an R-E.
Oh, that's even worse. Oof.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
So not capital
lowercase,
W
for sure.
Writer. So, Scott, you... this is an interesting interview because we are going to talk a little bit about you yourself, but you have a relatively new release out now that really focuses on an interesting and little heard part of the West Virginia music scene. It's a graphic novel and it's brilliant. But before we get into that, I do want to talk about you and set up who you are in the Mountain State. So where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Rainell, West Virginia, in Greenbrier County, and I was born in, I guess it's Fairley. That's where the hospital is in Lewisburg. So, yeah, that's where I'm from.
What was your childhood like growing up here?
Childhood? We are getting into Terry Gross questions.
It's not a big thing. I mean, just, to, you know, like, oh, I was born, you know, I went to school,
yeah,
I had a dog.
I went to school at Rupert and graduated from Greenbrier West. I had a good childhood. I had an amazing childhood. I probably had the best childhood you've ever had on West Virginia Public Radio or this podcast. I would classify it as A+.
Yeah?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, what about the music and arts? I mean, you obviously do care about the culture in West Virginia. What was it like growing up? Did you experience it around you?
No. I mean, I think I did experience it, but it's like culture that's different than what people typically think of as like culture.
What do you mean?
I don't know. Like, we have an idea of culture in this state as, you know, dulcimers and banjos. Or, I don't know, sort of progressive sort of ideas about music. And I think, you know, the culture that, you know, I grew up with was, you know, gas stations in Alabama, right? If you don't understand how amazing Alabama is, then, yeah, you probably don't know much. So yeah, I mean, that was like my culture. We saw the Statler Brothers at the State Fair 5 times.
Mm. Because four wasn't enough.
Four wasn't enough because they're amazing showmen. They're the vocal group of the year at the Academy of Country Music Awards. Probably, I think like they've won like 15, 16 of them. So that was, yeah, I mean, that was like, I didn't know anybody that, like, I mean, people, what's wonderful about this place is like people play music like in the evenings or tell stories in the evenings. You know, it's like to keep alive. It's not for just like some profession or to record an album or to you know, do something like that, which is, you know, always sort of, you know, taints it in some way, I guess. So yeah, I mean, I had no access to you know, culture in some ways, but I think there's nothing worse than culture, to be quite honest with you. I mean, mm-hmm. culture is like the Clay Center. Culture is like...
That's also, I mean, look, there's like different types of culture. Devil's advocate, so long as you are into something that brings life and energy and music or whatever it is in that capacity to you, it is culture, whether that's highbrow, lowbrow, somewhere
in
between.
Yeah, see, I would completely disagree with that. I mean, I don't think Doc Severinsen is culture. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's my answer.
you mentioned storytelling. You obviously are a storyteller yourself. Were there certain stories that you grew up with West Virginia that really made you believe in the power of the written word or you know, oral storytelling?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess some of those things are just kind of mythic, right? Like we have maybe the greatest myth. I wouldn't say maybe. We have the greatest myth in John Henry.
John Henry, yeah.
And we have the best ghost story in the Greenbrier Ghost. So, yeah, I mean, you're always kind of surrounded by that. I remember being a kindergartner and listening to an album that some kid brought in for nap time called Where's My Golden Arm? Have you ever heard that?
No, is that West Virginian?
It's just like some mass manufactured record that was produced in the 1960s that was like a storytelling record, and this woman had a golden arm. And then she dies, and so her husband buries her with her golden arm, but then he gets really poor, so he has to dig her up and get the golden arm. And so the story's all about she wakes up one night and, like, you know, comes from the grave asking, where's my golden arm? And so the whole entire track was about that until the very end where she is in his bedroom, and she goes, do you have it? And that's the way that the record would end. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, even that sort of stuff, like, you know, crappy records that you would get at, you know, a dollar store that had some sort of, you know, impact on me.
What about music? Was there any particular West Virginia musician that you grew up listening to?
You know, there's a musician that my dad always listened to called Mel Street, who is from Bluefield, right? It's sad nobody knows Mel Street anymore. He produced, I think, because, you know, he did some independent releases, but then I want to say he was on MCA, like, the late 70s, but he, like, committed suicide. He's from Bluefield.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that was the only, you know, Little Jimmy Dickens. I mean, there's a certain kind of West Virginia connection there. Connie Smith, you know, the singer, she's, you know, lived in Hinton. So, I mean, there were always these kind of little West Virginia, you know, elements to it. I even want to say, you know, Mack Wiseman has lived in West Virginia for a period of time. But yeah, I mean, I never kind of looked at it as, you know, geographical in that way. I think that, you know, my father's music that he listened to was, you know, kind of like classic country.
That's,
you know, amazing, right? And, that maybe, you know, speaks for the place, even if those individuals aren't, you know, from there.
You've stayed in West Virginia now for, I'm going to guess your age is like 80 years old.
That's right. I'm an 80-year-old man.
So you've stayed in West Virginia
for... That's the reason why I had to go to the bathroom before the interview began. Bladder's full.
It's all right. Your AARP card is really
10
worth
minutes
it.
From now, go again.
You've been in West Virginia now for a number of years. You've stayed here. Is there a reason for that? I mean, obviously your writing is entrenched in where you're raised.
I know. I mean, I think it would all, not that I'm, I am comparing myself, but like it would be like ridiculous if like William Faulkner moved to like, I don't know, Minnesota, right? That'd be kind of silly. Not that I would never want to live in Minnesota.
Minnesota's a fine place.
Yeah, it seems like a nice place. Land of a thousand lakes. I have a Uncle Doug from Minnesota, and he seems to enjoy his Minnesota childhood. But yeah, I mean, in one way, it's, you know, it's the place I kind of know. I think I'm a regional person. Like, I lived in Huntington for a time. I lived in Morgantown for a time. And that doesn't seem like West Virginia to me. Yeah, I mean, that's how regional I am. Like, Huntington's like parts Kentucky, parts Ohio, parts like, you know, urban with, I'm doing scare quotes here, but nobody can see them. You know, parts kind of like, you know, urban West Virginia. And I mean, Morgantown is, you know, just a horrible, horrible college town. So I don't know if I could. Like, I think I've thought about it before. I mean, I love cities, you know, I love New York.
Yeah.
I love LA, I think even more than New York. But yeah, I don't know if I ever could. And I just luckily like wound up with a job that allowed me to stay here. So I probably would have been like every other person my age who's took off, right? But it's always been important to me to stay though, because since I had that A+ childhood, like I'm still close to my parents. I don't think I could like ever leave them. In a sense, I mean, I'm sure I'll probably have to leave eventually, but there's a great Terry Bradshaw story where Terry Bradshaw, I think he drafted by the Steelers, and he went to like Northern Louisiana or something, and they told him he was drafted by the Steelers, but it was in Pittsburgh. And, like, the agent was like, "But it's Pittsburgh." But Terry Bradshaw was like, "Wherever I'm at, right, it's going to be amazing."
Yeah.
And so I've sort of always kind of, you know, had that idea about any place that I've lived in. But yeah, I mean, who'd want to leave this place? You know, so.
For those that are just now getting into who you are as a person, they haven't read your writing. Can you talk a little bit about the books that you have written for the last few years leading up to like last year's release?
Yeah, well, I wrote, how many are there? I wrote a book called Stories 5. Which is unusual because it wasn't my fifth stories collection.
Makes sense, yeah.
Thought it was like a Die Hard type title though, you know, like or a Rocky title, like Rocky 5, with an exclamation point. And I wrote a book called The Collected Works of Scott McClanahan, Volume 1, mm-hmm. and which took like two of these small press books that I published with a publisher in Pittsburgh called Six Gallery Press, and then put them out again, and then I wrote a book called Crapalacha and a book called Hill William. So.
And Crapalacha is really the one that people latch on to.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the one that I guess sold 10,000 copies, so.
That's not a big deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not. I mean, it's really not. But in the world of books, but that would be a success. I guess 10,000 copies would be a success, even at like a major press, you know, FSG or Henry Holt,
yeah,
or somebody along those lines.
Hey, so long as people like beyond your immediate family bought the book, I think that's
still
a success.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're talking about a good press.
Yeah.
Is there something you would say characterize your writing as a canon? Is there something that you think brings people to what you're able to put into a book?
I have no clue. I have no clue.
You haven't locked into that secret, or else you'd like mass manufacture that.
And I don't think I'd even manufacture it if I could. Like, I've always written these books for me. I could like care less about the reader, to be quite honest. I mean, I've always tried to, I don't know, to, you know, something that authors never try to do, which is like, you know, make somebody laugh, make somebody cry. Like, more authors should probably look into that because it's, you know, it's a good way to tell a story. But I've always tried to entertain myself. And so, you know, if you try to entertain yourself or, you try to, like, shock yourself or disturb yourself, then it's probably going to shock and disturb other people. So that's the way I've always looked at it. There's a great Victor Hugo story, or at least there's a quote about Victor Hugo, you know, the French Romantic writer, that Cocteau said, where he said, you know, Victor Hugo is a madman who thinks that he is Victor Hugo. And that's, like, kind of part of it. Like, that kind of sums up. It's so ridiculous to write a book in this day and age. And, you know, almost futile in some ways to write a book. So I've always seen it in that way. Like, I was gonna make myself, right? I was gonna like create myself, create my own personality, create who I was to the world. You know, that, you know, make your myth sort of.
Well, you just said that earlier too. I mean,
yeah,
you basically
for sure.
you're projecting what you think.
Yeah, I wanted to be John Henry at the end of the day, and that's what's always so, you know, lovely about folk tales and folk myths is that it's ordinary people. You know, it's ordinary people that have some sort of power rather than what. I mean, I'm surrounded by contemporaries and, like, writers, and this is probably music scene stuff, too, right, where people really don't want to be doing what they're doing. They're just doing it because it seems cool, or they're doing it for a book deal, or, you know, worst comes to worst, like approval from their parents. I've never had any of those sort of things. I've done the book stuff because it's cheap, right? Like you can be poor as can be and write a book. All you need is a piece of paper and a pencil or a pen.
Yeah.
So
last year you wrote a tragic, beautiful, demonic graphic novel, and it's titled The Incantations of Daniel Johnston, and it was illustrated by Ricardo Cavallo. Did I get that name right?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't know. I've never met the dude.
And it was released through $2 Radio.
That was a big deal for me, even trying to figure out how to like spell his name.
Really? It doesn't seem too hard. I just wanted to make sure if I was pronouncing it. Ricardo Cavallo.
Yeah, he's an amazing artist.
But for those that don't know Daniel Johnston already, who is Daniel Johnston West Virginia Music?
Yeah. These are big questions. You know, the first question of Hamlet's, who's there, right? Which is like an unanswerable, or the first line of dialogue is who's there, which is kind of like almost an unanswerable sort of question when you try to like simplify these things. But I guess you could say he's this Church of Christ kid, I think would be important to say. He's this Church of Christ kid.
Now, where was he raised?
He's up around Parkersburg. For some reason, again, this has been a year ago. I haven't even thought about this book, so I can't remember the community. I mean, he's really into the Beatles, which I think is probably also important. And moved to Texas to live with his brother and started doing these little home recordings just by himself, which doesn't seem weird today. I mean, that's kind of the sound.
DIY,
of,
yeah.
You know, like bedroom pop, mm-hmm. you know, pitchforky type stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of even in the stuff he's doing, I think it's even more kind of, you know, interesting than even the kind of DIY, like punk stuff of, you know, the same era. And he's playing a chord organ, which is like, you know, like that bad musical instrument that was in every eighth grade music class,
yeah,
right? He's playing those and he's writing these songs. I mean, that's who he is, I guess. I mean, we could probably say if we were looking at it from, you know, a different angle, you know, the mental health issue is always brought up with Daniel Johnston, which I guess adds a certain element to the music. And there's this, you know, insane sort of story where he was flying home from one of the early, I want to say South by Southwest type gigs, and his father was a pilot. And he's having, episode because he hasn't been taking his medicine and crashes his father's plane, but they both survive. So, I mean, there's like story after story after story with Johnston like that. Every moment is a miracle. Imagine the thousands of years and genes that come together to make one brain. Daniel Johnston is a miracle too. But did his mother know when he was born about the softness of her little boy's heart? Did she know about the nightmares and the hurt to come? Did she know one day he would be on MTV? Everyone was someone's child once, remember? See him now with his brothers and sisters and a rainbow of doom above his head. But wait, this is important. Daniel grew up in West Virginia and went to the Church of Christ. It was here he learned about good and evil, God and the devil, the eyes of superheroes, and the wicked adventures to come. What Daniel didn't know was that there were worlds inside of him already. There are demons and hells inside of us all, and they are talking to us. Listen, you're a piece of shit. You're a fucking piece of shit. So Daniel decided to make things. He made 8mm films, and he had fun. There is only one thing promised to us from the Frankenstein's monster we make, and that's pain. Is that good?
That was great. Okay. So that was, again, from, you know, your graphic novel, The Incantations of Daniel Johnston, setting up the story of who Daniel Johnston was, raised in West Virginia, and then going out to become a musician that eventually appeared on MTV and inspired the Kurt Cobains, the Sonic Youths, countless alternative indie artists today, like Wilco and...
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, Cage the Elephant. Yeah. And what's interesting about him is that he is not really someone that's mentioned quite often in the same West Virginia music canon as, say, the Bill Withers or the Tim O'Briens, the Brad Paisleys. What exactly drew you to Daniel Johnston's story? Like, how did this graphic novel even come about with your involvement?
Well, I mean, it was just basically they were going to give me some money.
Oh, come on. And, it had to be more than that.
It was basically that. Yeah, I mean, I don't do this sort of thing. I've worked with Eric and Alonzo been off of $2 radio before. I was in between drafts of this new book that I'm getting ready to put out. And so I had some time to kill, and I thought it would be fun to work with him again. And really, you know, to use a stupid thing that guys on basketball teams say, at the end of the day, I just really liked Ricardo Cavallo's art. He's done covers for $2 Radio before. You know, he did the poster for Glastonbury a couple of years ago, and
wow.
he's done record covers. I don't even say he's done a record cover for Macklemore. Not that that's cool. yeah, he just, you know, he has a very, you know, unusual, you know, distinct sort of style. And I just loved it.
But prior to this, what did you know about Daniel Johnston? Was this your first?
You know, the typical, you know, everybody saw the, you know, the Devil and Daniel Johnston.
The documentary.
Which was Jeff Furstberg, I think it's like 2005, mm-hmm. somewhere around there.
Yeah.
He just made a film about Laura Albert, who was, you know, J.T. Leroy. And he made a film about Jad Fair. And so... just that. I mean, I remember being, this would have been like 99, probably 2000. Somebody burned me a bunch of Daniel Johnston songs, you know, from Napster. Because it was on Napster from, you know, that long ago.
Yeah.
And that's where I first heard Daniel Johnston. And, you know, the songs that, you know, the Daniel Johnston songs that mean, you know, something to me, I don't really care with for the typical like Daniel John, like Casper the Friendly Ghost. Like, I just think that's like stupid. you know, some of the things that people would typically know, or even like Walking the Cow, like there's like the bridge in Walking the Cow, I think it's really amazing. But, you know, the traditional sort of Daniel kind of greatest hits, I don't think are nearly as interesting as kind of, you know, the tracks that are sort of, you know, hidden and that people don't know as well, where there's not that kind of, I don't know, that childlike sort of wonder, like kind of gimmick that he has that runs through, especially a lot of those early recordings. So yeah, I mean, I just, you know, I knew, you know, I'm a music head and nut, and so, you know, I knew, I owned a couple of those, you know, tapes on CD.
Yeah.
But that was basically it. I mean, I was more interested, like, it had nothing to do with Daniel Johnston. You probably could have brought me like another West Virginia artist if it was paired with Ricardo Cavallo, and I may very well have written the text. So it was real practical. Especially when you're a writer. I mean, the thing that happens when you're a writer is, it's not like making an album, you know, like I was looking the other night, like Phil Spector recordings with my wife, and like there was a song coming out every couple of weeks. You know, I mean, that's pretty amazing. Or,
yeah.
Or you know, the Beatles, or you know, Creedence Clearwater Revival. You know, they're releasing, you know, 3-4 albums sometimes. The Kinks, I was listening to the Kinks the other night. There's an album every couple of months, and maybe that's the reason why those guys burn themselves out so quickly too. You know, writers are very different. I mean, writers, time consuming and. You know, you release a book and then it's 5 years later before you have another one come out. So it's real easy to forget you. So I sort of done it almost for a sort of kind of seductive little bit of PR where I was, you know, still present, still there, still doing interviews.
Yeah.
And I would be able to use the book to kind of hype the book that is out now. So, I mean, that was part of it.
So when did this project begin exactly? When
year
were
before,
you,
I think?
Well, so
Eric had, like, emailed me a couple of times, and I was just confused. I had no clue what he kept talking about, graphic novel. I was like, what are they talking about? And I didn't know if he wanted me to, like, write a graphic novel or what exactly the deal was, because, see, there's a completely different text that was published in Spain,
Cavallo's
really? Own text.
Yeah. Wow.
So really what I did... as I went back into the book and threw away all of his text and then just came up with my own.
Hmm.
You know, that was interesting to me, like that, you know, kind of Jack White idea of like the limitations being kind of freeing in some ways. I had all these pictures done already, so I was stuck. Mm-hmm. I had this whole entire book, and I had to work around the pictures in order to do what it is that I wanted to do with it. And I don't think I totally did what I wanted to do with it because I was kind of stuck, you know, with these limitations of panels that were already completed. And, you know, that somebody spent years on completing, so you can't just go back and change.
So you're saying that Ricardo made this graphic novel, did the drawings, the illustrations, all that. And then when it was given to you, you basically took away the Spanish translation
and
made it English. Just kind of...
I used Google Translate. I've had Spanish class, but I'm a product of the West Virginia public school system, so it was sort of like study hall. So I went and used Google Translate. And his text is real... I'm not trying to criticize his text. I mean, he's an artist. The text was wonderful for what it was trying to do, but it was fairly sort of logical, you know, chronological sort of telling of the story, almost as if it was this, you know, small little Wikipedia article.
Yeah. So you really, I mean, it does have a lot of personality, that writing, and there's times when it's very lighthearted and, you know, it's very happy, and then other times where you basically flat out tell the reader, this is a shit story.
Yeah,
this is the kind
of
story that you think is not real, and things happened that are so horrific.
Yeah.
Maybe that horror is going to be infused into your own life.
Yeah, and especially with an artist, because, you know, artists, you mentioned Sonic Youth and Nirvana, you know, those are kids who are interested in authenticity, right? Not Cobain so much, but, you know, Sonic Youth, like trust fundy kids, and they're so interested in that concept of what's real. So even this book, like, there's like a level of exploitation almost involved in it.
Well, did Daniel Johnston, did he know about this book when it was being written?
Yeah, I mean, Daniel, he's met Ricardo. I guess Ricardo's met him a couple times, so there's at least some sort of relationship there with the text. I'm not exactly sure with the Daniel Johnston people. I know it's his brother and his father. I'm not sure if, you know, he's totally aware of the book coming out again with this kind of English sort of remix of the text.
So they weren't even consulted in the research, like at least on your end, your research.
Yeah, exactly. I could care less.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that's the thing too. Like, I was kind of writing about myself. Again, I know it sounds ridiculous.
Really?
I wasn't that interested in Daniel Johnston. I was just interested in the ways that I could tell this little myth, right? And use elements about, you know, the things that I've noticed too. You know, book business is probably not that much different than music business. And,
So you're basically just, you know, beginning of the interview, you mentioned this mythology of making the normal man extraordinary.
And
you basically applied that to already a pretty interesting story of Daniel Johnston and making that even more of a West Virginia myth.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, exactly. And even with the West Virginia thing, I mean, he lives his life here. I mean, I think it has probably some sort of relevance to him, but I don't even know if I think of himself as a West Virginia artist, in the same way I don't even think of myself as a West Virginia artist, and that it sort of feels real limiting, right?
Yeah, but there's also a sense of, you know, I think with certain styles of music, a DIY artist or someone who's had to be on the outskirts of norm or a flyover country, you know, it's that kind of thing that defines an individual and gives them... this kind of grit or this unconventional nature that is not usually seen. So, and that way, I would say that it does define you. And of course,
I'd agree with that. But it would probably, you know, I don't know if it defines me any more than, I don't know, Memphis defined Johnny Cash, right? Is Johnny Cash a Memphis artist or is he an Arkansas artist? Or, I mean, he's still working out of the little local regional sort of scene.
Yeah.
Not to say that it's not important, but, you know, those records are made in Texas, right?
And I mean, he hasn't lived in West Virginia for years and years and years.
Austin, Texas, and dropping acid in Austin, Texas. You know, where are you going to drop acid in Parkersburg? there's a part of it, but at the same time, the West Virginia part, I mean, you know, we want to do those sort of things. We want to latch on to those things that that are a part of us. I know that Fred Sonic Smith, right? Originally from West Virginia, born in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. Well, I understand that, right? That's part of, you know, that's as much of an Appalachian story as somebody who stayed here, right? The diaspora of, you know, the kid who moves to Michigan with his folks in order for the family to work in auto plants. Is it a West Virginia story? Yeah, I think it's a West Virginia story, but it also has other elements too.
I think it's worth noting because you have a man who, granted, had a troubled youth, and up to a certain point, like early 2000s, I mean, you know, he had that plane crash that occurred.
Yeah.
All these different things happened that were just very, you can't believe that happened to an individual, especially someone who's bipolar. And yet he was able to create music that really, you know, made people stop and think, like, what the hell is this guy doing? Getting
yeah,
up on stage
sure.
and doing it.
Yeah, for sure.
And for that to be connected, even if it's just a minor way to West Virginia, to show that even if there is some madness, some beauty can come out of it, I think is still an interesting thing to bring up.
And I think the other reason why you're talking about reasons why I did this, like, I want to just, like, to put a giant curse on things.
You actually mentioned that in the book.
Like, I know it's like, kind of, like, ridiculous. Like, the curse I just thought was, like, fascinating to do that in a book of instead of, you know, most books are trying to give you a hug.
And they live happily ever
you
after.
You know, trying to give you a hug by the end. To one, not dispel these sort of visions and hallucinations that Daniel's going through, but, like, to give him some sort of, you know, credence to you know, try to understand them, not to immediately, you know, label them as this or that. But it's interesting that I do that, and the flood happens just a couple weeks before the Daniel Johnson book comes out.
The 2016 floods,
Not saying we created it, but who knows? Daniel became obsessed with the Beatles and decided to sing and play songs. He learned that when you found others, you made the second best word that starts with an F. That word is friends, and together you can sing about joy, happiness, not being nervous. I hate being nervous. Now that is something that we did add.
What was that?
Because the problem that they had with my text is they could expand the boxes, but they couldn't, within the file, make the boxes smaller. So really what I was doing is I was trying to, this is going to sound stupid too, I was trying to count the number of words in Spanish and then have the same, or at least the same amount of space in terms of English. And that was the trick. It was almost mathematical sort of problem more so than an artistic problem. But then we made these like little pages that are just white on their own and kind of stand off from the text, which wasn't in the original text, like a text that's embedded within the text.
Yeah, and you know, I wonder, when writing this, were you taking on the role as narrator of Daniel Johnston's story, or do you think this was almost like a third person, like Daniel Johnston's, some personality of his doing
I think
that?
It was me narrating it, but narrating it in third person. Yeah,
okay.
You know, talking about Daniel in that way, which is how we tell stories. It's always my problem with third person novels, is they just seem so made up, right? In that, you know, the purpose of a third person story is because Joni did something crazy yesterday, and I'm going to tell you what Joni did rather than trying to do this very, like, modernist sort of technique of the third person creating distance or the third person, you know, allowing the reader to, you know, have a different sort of experience, that omniscient sort of narrator that novels do real well in third person. And to be honest with you, novels are no longer the major third person form anymore.
Yeah.
You know, television, movies. I mean, they do it so much better. So,
well, even this, like you, it's a graphic novel, which is an interesting thing to choose for, you know, this kind of story. I think it adds to it in a way by making it such a visual form of this hysteria.
Yeah.
But
and so many like graphic novels too are like watered down movies. I mean, even like the best. Well, I wouldn't say that about the best. Like, you know, Chris Ware or Daniel Clowes, his work in the latter is, you can almost see it as a movie. They just don't have the money to make the movie, and they're artists in that sense. I mean, you know, look at any movie blockbuster of the summer. You know, it feels like a Frank Miller graphic novel of Batman from the late 80s, or, you know, it feels like The Watchmen or, you know, something along those lines. So, yeah, I even thought this was doing something a little bit different than the graphic novels that I've read. Not that I've read hundreds of graphic novels, but I've read 22.
No, very exact.
that's right. So yeah, it felt even different in that. It felt more like this little kind of prose poem about, rather than a narrative.
Well, we're, in the graphic novel, it kind of ends at, I wouldn't say the modern day, maybe a few years before the modern day, or like early 2000s, mid 2000s.
Yeah.
Where is Daniel Johnston today? Like, how is he living his life now compared to when he first began?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I don't know a whole lot. I know he's living down like Waller, Texas, I think is the name of the town that he lives in. He just put out, when's that last album of his that came out? Probably 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Dude that I want to say he's either a Saddle Creek guy or worked with Beck a lot, produced the album for him. It's a good album. I like it. There's the tendency with Daniel albums to kind of like, I don't know, shit on like the more contemporary stuff and always look back to those little tapes, those little sort of basement tape like
which is something
recordings
we haven't really talked about, but the tapes, he basically, when he was in Texas, he made the tapes himself out of his room and then gave them to people, but he never actually had original copies. So he basically went back to his room and re-recorded those tapes and get them out.
Yeah, exactly. I think probably the pinnacle, Dan, there's a producer, Kramer, his name's Mark Kramer. And he's like, I don't know, discovered Ween. He produced Guar, Rob Zombie, Daniel Johnston. I mean, he's just one of these. Shimmy Disc was the name of the label that, yeah, was connected with Sonic Youth to a certain extent. That whole kind of New York underground, mid-80s, late-80s sort of scene. And he produced two albums with Daniel. Probably the first album, which I think is called 1990. Which is Daniel's, like, finest, I guess we could say, achievement. The songs are there, because some of the early stuff, it's almost like, I don't know, a sort of kind of bloated hip-hop album, right, where there's these little sketches, and he's doing voices, and then there's a song. There may be only one song on one side, and then you just have this other sketchy-type stuff. But, yeah, 1990 and the album that followed it, 1990 has Held the Hand, on it, and quite a few of the recordings that are in the documentary from the mid-2000s are off of that album, where you actually have a great, amazing, genius producer and engineer who can, make Daniel sound the way he needs to sound without taking away that that sort of raw sort of feel, from the early tape recordings.
If you... as the time of this recording, Daniel Johnston has not been inducted into the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
But he's been up for consideration. If you had to make a pitch to say why you think he deserves to be up there, what would you say? Or would you even make a pitch?
My pitch would be Daniel Johnston doesn't need the West Virginia Music Hall.
I mean, that's true.
Those recordings,
but no one really.
Those recordings are going to live forever. It would probably make sense if the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame tried to attach themselves to the coattails of
Daniel Johnston.
There's a kid right now, right? There's a chubby girl in Ohio right now who's listening to Daniel Johnston. And next year, when she's 15 years old, she's going to make an album. It's going to be like Mozart for people, right? So that's where, and that's where art lives, and that's where culture lives, right? Between people who are doing it.
Well, what is his legacy?
I think you can, everything you hear now, right? Everything you hear now has that feel as if it's almost been recorded in somebody. I'm not talking about the Dirty Projectors, Bon Iver sort of synthesizer-y thing that they picked up, off the 909 machine. I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about the things that that sound as if they've just been done right in somebody's garage and somebody's bedroom. I think that's Johnston, right? Those recordings, even if I don't like some of them, that he's doing in his brother's garage, those recordings still feel incredibly contemporary. And they were probably incredibly laughable, right, when they were done. And that's the purpose of, artists like Johnston is, to kick those things open so that, you can have the possibilities. Even in writing, we think of writers having an agent and you know, having a big publisher and a sort of Maxwell Perkins editor relationship with the writer. Well, you know, why? That makes no sense in this day
and age. And you could do it yourself.
Yeah. Why isn't someone just passing around their Microsoft Word document? That would be the same thing as what. And to be honest with you, people are doing that, right? And they're there, and they figured that out. One thing though, that I want to mention with Johnson, you have a number of people. Like, that's what's always so interesting about art or music or books. It's not so much Johnson that does it, but like the people that surround him. I can't remember the guy's name. I'm having a mental block, but the guy copied down Chaucer's Canterbury Tales.
Oh yeah.
Right. You wouldn't have known of the Canterbury Tales if there hadn't been this individual 10 years after Chaucer's death who decided to make a copy from which, you know, springs up. Or, you know, Ben Jonson and, you know, the Friends deciding to do, you know, Shakespeare's first folio. So though that's fascinating in that, you know, Daniel has, you know, Jeff Tartikoff, right, who helps popularize Daniel Johnson, who, because an artist like Johnson, like all really, you know, unique, unusual artists, they always had to be contextualized for people.
And contained.
For them to kind of understand what it is that they're doing. And Tartikoff was able to contextualize Johnston to a late 80s, early 90s audience, which is, you know, this is part Yoko Ono's recordings. This is part, this is part that, but with these little simple Beatle-like melodies that will get into your to your head. So we want to have always this, you know, struggling artist, doomed artist sort of cliche, which that doesn't exist usually. That's part of the story, but there are always these other individuals who are part of the story as well. To be quite honest with you, you know, Jeff Farrisburg or whatever his name is, if he doesn't make the documentary, you know, I'm sure that Ricardo Cavallo, this Spanish guy, in Madrid or Barcelona or wherever he's from, probably doesn't hear about him, right? So it's these strange little bits of luck that, you know, keep these recordings, keep books, keep poems, keep these things that are, you know, important to us going. We love Nirvana and we love Kurt Cobain because of capitalism, right?
Because it was sold to us. They look good on T-shirts.
Yeah, it was sold to us, and it was you know, we were told that this was amazing. I've been watching David Lynch's, you know, Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
If you don't have David Lynch's name on that and I were to watch this right now, I don't know if I would like it. I don't know if I would have made it up to the fourth episode with Dougie. Right.
You're spoiling it for everyone that hasn't watched.
That's right. Who is still the same Dougie of episode 3. So, but you continue on, right?
Yeah.
There's amazing things in it, not to say that, of course. But, yeah, it's part of, yeah, this sort of idea you have about something. You want to say that you like something because you like it, when in reality, maybe there are all these other sort of factors, too, that play into it and that are affecting you.
Well, would you call the story of Daniel Johnston a cautionary tale for musicians or anyone that's wanting to get into this line of work? I mean, I don't know if I would in a way. If anything's cautionary, it's just that his mental health, but that's something you can't exactly control.
Yeah, exactly. And even with that said, I went, my wife and I, it's the type of girl she is, we went to Weston.
Oh, the asylum.
For her birthday.
Right, yeah.
Two or three years ago, maybe even 3 years ago now. And I had an uncle at Weston. You know, Weston was always this scary place where, you know, we had this sort of feel of lobotomy about
it's
the place.
It's haunted now, yeah.
It's haunted now. And there were those things. I'm not discounting those things. But at the same time, it was also people's homes. You know, there were a number of people who lived there who probably had friends and people who cared for them, people who were trying to help them in that sense. So yeah, I don't want to turn it into, because that's what we always do, right? We always turn it into this negative that maybe is not necessarily so.
Although you do curse people in the
book. Yeah, we do curse people for sure.
You do say you're going to walk away from this book and you're going to have a darkness within
you. Yeah, exactly. And I think that at the same time, it's that notion of, you know, laugh and the devil flees, right? Mm-hmm. It's part comedy, It's part serious.
Just like West Virginia?
As well. Because it's an incantation. There's all this occult black magic thing that runs through it. I almost looked at it in that way, is this kind of strange sort of darkness that gets passed on. There's great writer Ishmael Reed, who wrote a novel called Mumbo Jumbo, right? Mm-hmm. Mumbo Jumbo is what's passed on between artists, and it's a sickness, and it's a fever. All the great jazz artists, why they die the way they do, right? Well, they allowed Mumbo Jumbo, that mojo, to be passed on between them, that, of course, is going to lead them to a life where they're not just simply dying in their beds with their shoes off. It's gonna lead them to a life of darkness, which is part myth.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, smirk at that and shake my head no at the same time. But yeah, maybe we're taking away from the doomed artist myth and then kind of reestablishing it at the same time. Lay not up your treasures in MTV. I repeat, lay not up your treasures in MTV. Because the things we hope and pray and wish for sometimes destroy us. Dreams are dangerous things. So stop for a moment. These are the voices inside of your head shouting, you're a piece of shit. Go kill yourself. Is that it?
That's it.
Yeah.
Listen up and I'll tell a story.
Scott McClanahan is the author of The Incantations of Daniel Johnston, available from $2radio.com, Amazon, and wherever good books are bought. And his newest release is The Sarah Book. 30 Days of West Virginia Music is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and A Change of Tune. This episode is written, edited, and produced by me, Joni Deutsch. Our associate producer is Nathan Thomas. Our digital promotions come from Josh Saul. Our theme was composed by Matt Jackford and performed by Montana Skies and John Query. You can hear more West Virginia music on A Change of Tune, airing Saturday nights at 10 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Follow us on social media. We're at A Change of Tune. And for more West Virginia music chats, make sure to go to wvpublic.org/wvmusic and subscribe to our podcast feed. I'm Joni Deutsch. Thanks for listening.